Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, October 1st, Joe was joined by founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and the professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz, Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
The meeting yesterday regarding military leaders, and I don't know how much you all got to see of this. It was unlike anything I've ever seen. And so we will, here's basically in a nutshell. In the end, it was just another campaign-style presentation. President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth recited a familiar litany of partisan culture war talking points in their highly anticipated call-up of several hundred military officers on Tuesday. This from the New York Times. In a rambling and sometimes incoherent speech in which he praised his own tariffs, insulted former President Joe Biden, Mr. Trump disclosed that he had told Mr. Hegseth to use American cities as training grounds for the military. It was an evolution of one of Mr. Trump's favorite themes, that cities run by Democrats are lawless urban hellscapes. But now he was telling military commanders charged with waging war his thinking on where their next deployment could be. It seems that the ones that are run by the radical left Democrats, what they've done to San Francisco, to Chicago, to New York, to Los Angeles, they're very unsafe places, the president told the generals and admirals at a military base in Virginia. And we're going to straighten them out one by one, and this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room. That's a war, too, Mr. Trump said. It's a war from within. The comments were greeted by expressionless faces. The Pentagon senior military leaders had warned the officers not to react or cheer per the norms of what is supposed to be a nonpartisan military. The result, the audience was quiet and much more still than Mr. Trump usually encounters in his stump speeches. One senior officer said they were told to clap only when the Joint Chiefs of Staff did, like at the State of the Union address.
Several issues here. And there are a couple of silver linings. Unprecedented, I would also argue that it was unnecessary to put the national security at such a risk. And we're not talking enough about the fact that we could have been in a very difficult situation should somebody have decided to take a whack at all of our senior military commanders. I did appreciate the stillness. I know it was not appreciated by the president, who was pitching for applause as if it was some comedian game show. I also appreciate the fact that the troops didn't see their commanders getting behind some of the outrageous statements that were being made by both Hegseth and Trump. I don't think this is being reported enough. The incoherence of Donald Trump and the slurring of his words is something that we cannot continue to ignore. And if you looked at that, and if you looked at what happened in the Oval Office yesterday, there is a clear cognitive decline that is going on with Donald Trump, and I want to put a marker in that because I think this is a problem this country is going to have to face before the end of his current administration. The language, this idea of the training ground and the war within, I will just poke at the hypocrisy of Fox and some of the right wing media about. I think it is unacceptable. I think I would tell you right now that if it was a Democrat, a Democratic administration who made that, I would tell you that it was unacceptable. But the idea of even the threat of use of military force against Americans, to me, is one of the most egregious issues facing the country. And that's on top of all the other issues that we were talking about. My only hope is that the military command will remember their oath is not to the president, but it's to the Constitution, because we're setting some seeds that really, really worry me, and I think lead to potential abuses that we really should be talking about.
We are talking about the meeting that took place yesterday as the president and the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, recounted familiar partisan complaints to top military leaders. And so we welcome your letters on that. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Bo.
Yeah, so I'll say a couple of quick things that I think the media is not paying as much attention to, although they're paying some attention to it. So I want to focus on two things in particular, two messages that Pete Hegseth in particular brought out to the generals. One is the woke mentality of, you know, we're going to eliminate the woke mentality in the Defense Department. I refuse to call it the Department of War. I'll call it the Defense Department. One of the interesting things is that he's speaking in a vacuum, in large part. There has been a long conversation about diversity in the military that dates back for quite a while, and I'll bring up just two moments of that long conversation. In the early 2000s, when the Supreme Court was considering the idea of affirmative action in colleges and law schools coming out of the University of Michigan, there was an amicus friend of the court brief that had been signed by Norman Schwarzkopf and 35 other of the most important generals saying, and I'll quote, this one's from the 2023 one, but the quote from this amicus brief, this friend of the court brief to the Supreme Court, diversity in the halls of academia directly affects performance in the theaters of war. And the 50-page document goes on to talk about the value of having a diverse military, especially at the top, for not only the quality of the work that goes on the battlefield, but the morale of the soldiers and so on. So there's a whole bunch of Republican voices out there that are opposed, and some of the great historical thinkers, Colin Powell and so on, who are opposed to exactly what Pete Hegseth is saying about this sort of very shallow, superficial notion of what diversity is. Secondly, the piece, this is my last point, the piece through strength argument that Pete Hegseth talks about, I'm troubled by the piece through strength argument. Of course, Trump admires those that display peace through strength, or at least pretend they do, Putin, Xi, Kim Jong-un, Netanyahu, peace through strength mentality. And Trump sees European leaders as weak, those who lean towards diplomacy as opposed to bombs and bullets. He sees those leaders as weak. He forgets, though, that he ignores the lessons of Vietnam when we tried to change regime democracy through strength, and that didn't work out too well. He forgets the lessons of Afghanistan and Iraq when we're doing the same sort of things. Sure, the legacy of the Cold War, America was able to win the Cold War, but primarily because of our economic dominance, not necessarily only because of our superior military force. So this peace through strength argument, I'm opposed to as a good, solid Democrat. I actually think diplomacy is always the first order of business. This administration seems to think otherwise.
I mean, yes. And peace through strength is a misnomer. It's really peace through violence, and we should call violence what it is. On the DEI and recruitment piece, I'll just start by saying my mom was in the Army and my dad is Mexican and was in the Marine Corps, and both of my step parents, my stepmother and my stepdad, were in the military, and so my mom was part of the service as a in this administration's viewpoint as a DEI hire and recruit, and so was my dad. And I just think of the way that this administration talks about our service members and how deeply offensive it is to the tens of thousands of people who are now being identified as DEI recruits or being allowed to serve this country, which they do with honor and with respect for the Constitution, as just so demoralizing. When, at a moment when recruitment for the military is down by more than 25% and missing its mark on over 15,000 recruits a year, I agree with Bo that we know statistically that diversity brings a wealth of knowledge and experience, cultural humility and competency. But we also know that we need to, if we are in agreement that we need more service members, we need to expand that recruitment pool into deeper and more diverse populations in order to meet those goals. Now, I don't know, maybe we're not in agreement about needing to have more soldiers. That's a different conversation. But if the agreement is we need to fill those ranks, you have to do that with more diverse applicant pools. And that only happens if you're not out there calling people fat beardos, because that is just a gross way to talk about our service members.
Roger.
Yeah, I mean, it was very difficult to watch this thing. I didn't watch the whole thing. I watched parts of it, and it was disturbing. You know, I think the first thing I want to say is it's worthwhile having a conversation about DEI in general at universities, where I think it's had positive impacts in certain ways and negative impacts. And I don't think it's terrible for the Secretary of Defense to want to have a conversation about it. That said, I agree with Nick 100%, right? It's offensive the way they're going about it. There's a certain irony to call people unqualified when Pete Hegseth is about as unqualified as you can imagine to be the Secretary of Defense. You know, competence and humility, the two sort of core values of the Marine Corps, there's certainly no competence and there's certainly no humility. This was a flex, if I can use that word here. I mean, again, I've said before, I think we have to understand what's going on. The president and his inner circle want the kind of power that we call tyrannical power. They want to have the military bow to them. They want to have the universities bow to them. They want everyone to kiss their ring, their hands, whatever it is. He wants power. He wants to be able to push a button or tell someone to push a button and blow up a Venezuelan speedboat against the rules. He wants the military to sit there and have to listen to him. Hegseth could have gone out and talked to people and had real conversations about DEI or about training or fitness. By bringing them in, as Bob said, into this very dangerous situation and making them sit there, it's just about power. And we have to understand that that's what's going on, which is why this shutdown is actually meaningful. Because if one side is going to play by power, right, the question is, what does the other side do? Do they bring a knife to the gunfight or do they play by the same rules? I still don't know what the Democrats are going to do. I'm not sure what they should do. But if you're gonna fight Trump, if you think he's dangerous, it may be that the only way to fight him is through competing on the realm of power, and that's going to get dirty and difficult.
And Joe, I think Roger makes some really interesting points that I would also toss this out, is that I do worry that as a country that we've forgotten about the value of human life. So some of the language that I've saw, and I saw a really interesting article about how where Hegseth wants to go is back to the 1990s, where we know that the military had some real moral issues. And I also worry that we have a president who obviously did not serve in the military. None of his children have served in the military. So the idea of the military becomes sort of this abstract concept that that other people will do it, and it's glorious, and it's almost back. We're almost back to the sort of the British model of elites in the officer corps, and the scrubs of society will go in and wage war, and while it's glorious, they don't think about the death and disaster that goes along with this. And the leadership of this country should, in my mind, only be using the military as the very last resort, not the first, which I think gets back to what you said, Bo, and I think that's really an important point. But as a society, are we prepared for our children who are in the military to sacrifice because of the narcissistic leadership of this administration? And that's another one of those sort of third rail issues that I fear that given Hezgat and given Trump that they are too willing to use the military because the cost isn't theirs to bear.
So where do you think this goes? I mean, obviously members of the military who are in that group aren't going to speak out. Aren't.
They should. And they should resign.
And I do think they look. I mean, there were a number of people who were quoted on the condition of anonymity and so forth over the last 24 hours. But
can I say something to that?
Yes, absolutely.
There's an old debate that goes back, you know. I mean, it goes back all the time, but was widely talked about in the 1930s and 40s, both in Germany and in Soviet Union, of whether you should stay in the government and try and, you know, soften things or whether you should resign, right? We had it with Nixon. We've had a lot of these issues. And it's often phrased in the terms of the lesser evil. The problem with the lesser evil is that if you're really talking about evil, it's still evil.
Yeah.
And at some point, it's better to resign, walk away. It's not clean your hands and serve as an act of resistance than to continue to play in that game. And I think there's a lot of people in the military who still think we can save this military institution. And like I did not serve in the military, but I am constantly telling my students, you should. I think, you know, it's an act of patriotism. I think one of the things that would help this country immeasurably is mandatory public service, whether it's military or something else. But I think that there's a great tradition of people who serve in the military who believe in public service, who believe that it's the foundation of a diverse and orderly and legal republic. And I think it's being taken apart. And I'm not sure whether people should stay in it and try and save it from within or leave. But I think that pretty soon they're going to have to make that decision. And they probably are going to have to resign if they want to keep their soul.
There's a third option. Mm-hmm. Wait until you're removed, right? If you decide to stay in a position and you then do push back on that administrative directive and you do so steadfast and honorably and within the confines of the law, you wait until you're removed. And I think that sends a stronger message than acquiescing at leaving before.
I agree. I'm with you on that.
Everything hits the fan. Yeah. So to me,
I meant speak out and get removed. You know, be willing to speak out and get removed.
But I do see that there are a number of generals, a number of leadership individuals who are speaking out, who are standing their ground and who are saying, come say it to my face.
Yeah. I love the idea of Roger, what you're talking about. And Nick,
yeah,
I like
30 seconds.
Yeah, I like the third option. In the cacophony of social media and the fact that the media itself is being blurred by so many voices, I'm not sure anybody who walks away can get a platform or a bullhorn enough to make a difference. And I think that probably makes people reluctant.
That was Bo Breslin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, October 1st. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, October 2nd, Joe was joined by CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio, and former Times Union Associate Editor, Mike Spain.
We have the shutdown, of course, to talk about the Trump administration seeking to exert control over the government shutdown. A lot of aspects to this, a lot of facets to it. We'll try to, I'll read some general information, and then we can go in whatever direction the panel would like to as far as their particular concern or interest in this issue. The Trump administration began to exert its power over the government shutdown Wednesday, blaming Democrats for imminent layoffs of federal workers, tying up infrastructure projects in blue states, and posting partisan messages on government websites that deflected blame for the stoppage in crucial federal services. So, if you go to the government website, it would pop up and it would say, you know, the lazy do nothing liberals.
I think are extreme left wing or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
It was not maybe something that you would expect to see on a government website, but there it is. Most federal government functions were halted after funding ran out and Congress deadlocked over how to extend spending laws. Vice President J.D. Vance said that officials were, quote, going to have to lay some people off during a prolonged shutdown to prioritize funding for essential services. Though the size of the federal workforce is unrelated to the country's financial health during a lapse in funding. Senate Democrats, for their part on Tuesday, blocked a Republican bill that would have extended federal resources for 7 weeks. Republicans in the chamber blocked a Democratic bill that would have done the same while also extending subsidies for health insurance coverage. The GOP bill failed again in a Wednesday vote. Congress is off today for Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. The two sides in the White House have dug in. Donald Trump and Republicans have barreled us into a shutdown because they refuse to protect Americans' health care, said Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the floor of the chamber. Vance, speaking from the White House press briefing room, shot back that Democrats were holding government services hostage to achieve unrelated policy goals, which he falsely said mostly centered on providing health care to undocumented immigrants who are eligible for federal benefits. Although he said, we are willing to talk. There you go. Heather.
Yeah. First off, I personally think there's no doubt that the reason that there's going to be a shutdown is because there are not Democratic votes. And if everyone recalls, last time there was the threat of a shutdown, Chuck Schumer decided, and I think correctly so, to bring the votes to make sure that the interim spending measure was passed. He didn't do that this time. So to say that it's the fault of the Democrats, I think technically is correct. This is a continuation. It's not a change in funding. So they were okay with voting for this last time. But now there's some looming changes, I think, in the reimbursement or the subsidies for health care, the health care programs. And they're trying to leverage that. I think they're going to get the blame for it. I think the use of the websites to further politicize this is a massive mistake on the part of Republicans. I don't, or the administration, I should say. I don't think that if you asked, you know, the Republican leadership if that was a good idea, they probably wouldn't have said independently of the administration that it was. But, you know, it's just another continuation of hyper-partisan division that just punishes Americans. And I think that is really unfortunate. I wish, you know, some grown up would take control of the wheel here and get us back on track.
You may have buried the lead there a little bit. I think what happened with the continuing resolution and Schumer's bringing it to a vote last time is exactly why we're having this shutdown.
Yeah, no, that's true. I'm sorry.
He paid a price with his base, you know, which wants him to fight. You know, now whether the fight is going to come to any good end or not doesn't matter. They want to fight. And I would point our attention, there was a terrific editorial, I shouldn't say terrific, surprising editorial in the Washington Post yesterday the editorial board said Democrats have been marched into a shutdown trap, and it dwelled on this topic. And I'll quote from that editorial. It said, chances are slim that the two parties, meaning the Republicans and the Democrats, could ever come to terms that Democratic activists would view as a decisive victory. Yet the party's base wants them to fight anyway, even if it means holding the government hostage. So you have significant voices on the left saying, what the heck are we doing this for? We're not going to win. And my colleague at the American Enterprise Institute, Matt Continetti, you know, rather wryly yesterday on the commentary podcast, said we're having the shutdown because, quote, because Chuck Schumer is afraid of a girl, meaning Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and being primaried. And I think that's
probably
right.
Wow. So it's junior high. I was like,
exactly.
Well, I mean, he's said as much as worried about his reelection chances. And I don't know, Mike. I guess we were talking about cynicism earlier before we went on the air. But I mean, I just wonder, why can't we blame both?
Well, I think it is both sides that are to blame here. But the last time, Heather, you brought up how Schumer did not bring a shutdown when they had to do the first continuing resolution. And I think that was the right choice. I think it was the wrong time to do it. It was not clear why they were doing it. And he took a lot of heat for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the girl that he's afraid of, you know, AOC. And
she's a woman. I'm just going to say that.
I know, but they refer to her that way because she's so much younger, and she is so much younger than Chuck Schumer, who's in his mid-70s. And she's, I think, the youngest sitting member of the House of Representatives. Mm. Yeah, and the youngest ever elected, I believe,
Is she? I thought maybe Elise Stefanik was the youngest ever elected.
She is younger than Stefanik, but Stefanik may have been. Well, that's a good. Hey, our audience will clarify that for us, won't they?
I bet it comes down to like being like the youngest Democrat, the youngest Republican, like that kind of thing.
Yeah,
we'll see what.
Whichever
we could split.
Whichever, but exactly. But comparatively, I think old guys look at her as a girl, and that's a big mistake because she's a powerful woman. Anyway, after that last debacle where Schumer took a lot of heat for not cooperating with maybe the more liberal members of his caucus to force a shutdown, he's doing it this time. You know, polls show that Trump's numbers are going down, 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 with independents, obviously with Democrats. And there's a little bit of erosion among Republicans when it comes to health care, especially. Mm-hmm. But they're not saying, oh, I want the alternative and turning to the Democrats. They don't know what the Democrats stand for. Mm-hmm. I think the Democrats see health care is the issue that can unite people. They may disagree about immigration. They may disagree about other issues. But they see health care as a winning issue, even if they lose and they don't get some kind of even temporary extension of the health care insurance subsidies that are very expensive. And they ought to talk about ways to phase them out. But they're really going to hit, and they're going to hit in states that didn't do Medicaid expansion, especially. And those are Republican states. There's people who might make $60,000 a year. And are their insurance costs under Obamacare are going to go up to like $20,000 a year? And that will mean they'll stop having insurance and they won't be able to afford it. Mm-hmm. And it'll increase by millions of people, those without any health insurance. And that's at a time when Medicaid has been slashed and rural hospitals are going to close. It's going to be a mess. And the Democrats are trying to underscore that. And they're saying, let's talk about it now, because if you wait to November, like the Republicans are saying, we'll talk about it in November. It won't happen. Maybe they'll get some attention and get some momentum. They may end up compromising or folding, and a few more Democrats may go along just to end the pain. And there is a lot of pain. And there will be efforts to make sure that, I mean, Trump, the one thing he's not is secretive. He's very transparent. He's going after the Democratic states to make them feel the pain. And he says so. And they are. And New York City already got on hold two major, major infrastructure projects that have been long delayed, like the tunnel under the Hudson River over to New Jersey to, you know, take some of the enormous traffic congestion there, and then the extension of the East Side Subway, which has been in the works for years. They're now on hold, according to Russell Vogt, the budget director. So the pain is being inflicted, and it's kind of a zero-sum thing. It's almost a Pyrrhic victory. Whoever wins, it's going to inflict a lot of damage on them while it takes damage on the other side.
Mike, can I ask you, you clearly are a lot more well-versed on the ins and outs of health care and health insurance than I am. But one of the things that struck me in thinking about this morning is the absence of pain. In other words, okay, you know, and again, we're all kind of, you know, political wonks and whatnot in this room. But among, you know, the average American.
Proud wonk.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a proud whatnot, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, Social Security benefits are still coming. The post office is still running. Veterans benefits are not being touched. You know, it's not as if, you know, our armed services are being recalled from overseas. In other words, doesn't the average person say, well, wait a minute, what's changed from yesterday to today? I'm not sure that there's going to be an ordinary man in the street experience of pain. So this ends up feeling like what? Political theater.
Right. And if you're not feeling the pain, maybe you don't mind it extending on. But if you're a member of somebody's family where they're drawing on a salary, they work for TSA, let's say, or they work for any number of government agencies, and they're being furloughed, they're not going to get paid.
Yeah.
And then what about people who are required to go to work and still not going to get paid?
But this is where this redounds to the benefit of the Republicans, right? Mm-hmm. Last time I checked, Trump was trying to downsize the federal government. Well, mm-hmm. now you've basically created a permission structure for him to say, look, it's not my fault.
Yeah, he has made that threat, and so has J.D. Vance yesterday, that they're going to use it to do layoffs and restructure government.
I just want to interject. Yeah. I mean, I think the only saving grace here for the Democrats, really, is that the Republicans are so bad at their messaging here. I mean, like, really? Yeah. This whole, like, you know, we don't have continued funding, so we're going to punish you, the American people. I mean, that is the message that's out there. And they're saying, okay, it's the other guy's fault.
Yeah.
But they're saying the reason that we're not doing what they want is because they want to provide health care for illegal, undocumented, whatever the correct terminology is. But everyone knows that's not the case, right? So
I think their
credibility on that point is so thin.
Well, but I think you're not contradicting my point. You're kind of amplifying it. In other words, if the average American doesn't feel pain, then they listen to the rhetoric about downsizing the government and say, well, wait a minute. You know, you're downsizing the government. You shut it down. My life doesn't feel any different.
Like, so, don't screw around with the mail. Like, I want to make sure I get my Social Security.
Right, sure.
Exactly.
So you might be right, Mike, but
But you see, the pain of health insurance subsidies ending is not going to be felt until 2026.
Right, so shut down the government then over it.
Yeah. But to Heather's point, which I think is a good one, is that, but it seems like there's two messages coming from the Republican Party. You have the Republican leadership that's going up there and talking about the issues and about CRs and a clean CR. And right. then you have the president saying and the vice president saying, we're going to do this. And then it's like, and then whenever you ask the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate about that, they're like, well, you have to ask them about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, people are beginning to see the damage that, you know, Elon Musk did with Doge, and they're beginning to feel the.
I don't know.
I'm not so sure about that.
I'm not.
I think public opinion on that is shifting, is what I'm saying. Maybe the full impact of it won't be felt until the next year when the money's not
there. There was just a poll out, like, this week that basically showed. Now, his numbers are not good, but they're the same amount not good as they were 4 months ago, which to me is like, to your point, I think that if you keep saying this is going to be a catastrophe, this is going to be terrible, and then the terrible doesn't happen, you lose credibility. And I think that's why, I mean, people are really unhappy, but his numbers haven't like gone down. They've just stayed down.
So strategy-wise, you think that it should be after people lose their health care subsidies?
No, I don't. I don't. Yeah. But I think.
But when can they? I
if
think
they never do, yeah. then you're back to being Chicken Little again.
Right. But they could have. I mean, and I think it would have been a disaster. The Democrats could have said, "We're going to do this to protect the Constitution. We're going to do this because of unlawfully using the Justice Department to go after political enemies. We're going to do this because we, you know, are balking on funding Ukraine, or we're city, you know, marching troops into Portland and Chicago."
It's a better argument.
And yeah. Those are all reasonable arguments, but I don't think they carry the weight of your health care is going to cost you double, at least.
I could be wrong about this, but I assume the reason that they don't make that argument, which would be more persuasive to me as somebody on the center right who has trouble with some of those things, it's because you can't draw a straight line between that and the continuing resolution.
Yeah. This you can, though. I mean, the way it was set up during Biden's administration, these health care subsidies had to, Joe Manchin wouldn't let them become permanent.
Right, that's right.
So they had to sunset. And they made them sunset the same time that Trump's tax cuts or income tax breaks were sunsetting. So it put the Republicans in an awkward position earlier this year of not extending the health care subsidies, but then continuing the tax cuts. And they went ahead and did it because they have control. They have the numbers. They control all the branches of government. So that now the Democrats don't have much of a hand to play, but if they have a hand to play, it's health care.
I defer to you on that, but I think I'm more persuaded by Heather's view of this, and to say, look, if this is just about political theater, this is just about my progressive left demanding that I fight, then you might as well have the fight on purely rhetorical terms.
That was Robert Pondicio on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, October 2nd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, October 3rd, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler, an RPI graduate student and former grade school teacher who has returned to graduate school to get a PhD, Sophia Kisto.
All right, let's talk about the shutdown. And this was an exclusive from the Washington Post, which I thought was interesting. I don't think it's especially surprising, but there's actual reporting done here that would indicate of what's going on behind the scenes to back up what I think the hunch was of what was happening behind the scenes. And that is that senior federal officials have quietly counseled several agencies against firing employees while the government is shut down. The president has suggested he will do this, warning that the strategy may, those who are questioning this say that the strategy may violate appropriations law, according to two people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive internal deliberations. The officials caution that firings known as RIFs or
RIFs.
Reductions in force. There you go. You're not techies. Could be vulnerable to legal challenges under statutes labor union cited this week in a lawsuit seeking to block threatened mass layoffs. For example, The Anti-Deficiency Act prohibits the federal government from obligating or expending any money not appropriated by Congress. It also forbids incurring new expenses during a shutdown when funding has lapsed. Some federal government officials have concluded that the prohibition could extend to the kind of severance payments that accompany reductions in force. So just for a little anecdotal background here, the government is shut down. The government's been shut down as of Tuesday. The Republicans and the Democrats cannot agree on a spending plan going forward. They are working on their, well, they are supposed to be working on their differences. A main concern among Republicans is health care. Then
a main concern about Democrats is health care.
Among Democrats is health care. What did I say?
Republicans.
I apologize.
Well, the Republicans concerned because they want to slash it. Democrats
yes.
don't want that.
I apologize. And then you have the president who's saying, okay, well, I'll show you. I'll fire these people. I'll stop these programs. I'll do this, and I'll do it in blue states. So it won't affect my people. It'll affect your people. And there you go. So again, this retribution that is going on. The Trump and Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt, whose office oversees apportionment law, has led the administration's preparation for terminations, and have repeatedly said mass dismissals would come during the government shutdown. Plans for such firings have been developed at several agencies, according to two federal officials familiar with the matter, who, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity. Those plans, which have yet to take effect, outline firings for fewer than 16,000 people, a senior White House official said, a smaller riff than what the White House had previously projected. I'm going to ask a very simple question to start us off, Teresa Bourgeois. Why is this significant?
Why is it significant that the Trump-Vance Vogt administration wants to fire people during a shutdown? Or why is this?
Obviously, they want to do this. And obviously, there is great concern. And I guess I'm interested of the significance of those who are there in the room saying, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, because it's illegal. That's why it's significant. So this is a continuation of
Which hasn't stopped them
before. No, well, that's, yeah. So this is the only thing different is that they... So, and really, at the heart of the Democrats' refusal to go along with the continuing resolution are two things. One is protecting these really devastating health care cuts that are going to start almost immediately. And people keep saying they're not going to start right away, but they're going to start almost immediately because they will have a tremendous economic impact on the personal lives of the people and on the health care business and on the communities in which there is healthcare industry. So, but the second thing is that the Democrats want to say that you, the Trump administration, cannot keep doing what you're doing, which is violating, you know, the First Amendment, which is the administration is ignoring the mandates, the legal mandates of the Congress, and they are withholding or withdrawing or cutting funding, cutting people, and not running the government as the Congress has instructed them to do. So that's really when the Democrats are saying, you know, we're not going to vote for this. What they're not going to vote for is this devastation of the healthcare system and of this illegal activity that's been going on since January that was outlined in Project 2025, which Donald Trump had said he never heard of and didn't know what he was, and they were a bunch of radical people, and he didn't agree with it. Of course, yesterday he acknowledged the truth, which is he embraced it, he loves it, he loves his votes. That's why he's put him in charge of it. So what these people in the room are saying is finally it sounds like there's some people in the room talking to the Trump administration people saying, bridge too far. This is illegal. You cannot do this. You cannot fire all of these people. You shouldn't have been doing it. You can't do it now. So, but I think
it's true, it is illegal, but the Republicans are not telling the truth about what the cuts in health care mean, right? No. They are saying that the Democrats just want to provide health care to illegal immigrants. That is false. They know it's false. They keep repeating it. And everyone says, oh, they have a clear message. They have a message that's clearly a lie. That's the only thing clear about that message. It's clearly a lie. It's not true. And they also say, well, these won't have an impact right away. Vance has said, oh, you know, and right. Johnson, oh, we can do this later. And I know I'm talking a lot, sorry. But just understand, and I'd be interested if any of the listeners have gotten their letters yet, because I know some people who have. These cuts go into effect beginning in January if you are on the exchanges, if you have so-called Obamacare. But you have to sign up or re-sign up in the next, you know, by mid-December. And people are already starting to get their notices saying what their premium increases are going to be. And the premium increases, according to KFF, Kaiser Family Foundation News, the best health news that I can find, you know, straight up, not biased, just factual, is these rate increases are going to be up to 79%. And then some people, like, you know, I got a letter saying that the plan I'm on is no longer going to be offered. So I have to go find a new plan. And if they wait till December, at the end of December, make these changes, then where's the window for people like me who now have to go find a new plan? And rural hospitals
are already
closing. Virginia, yeah. Three key rural hospitals in anticipation of the rising costs that are going to happen because I'm talking too much.
Well, you're not talking too much.
I mean, I want to hear other people.
I do too. But let me just ask you a quick question, and then we'll go to a break, and then we'll come back and we'll listen to everybody else. This obviously isn't helping the negotiations of trying to end the shutdown.
We're saying that it's illegal?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the overall situation.
Let's be clear. The Republicans are not negotiating. And part of the problem here was, so Trump lays out his budget proposals, right? That happened a while ago. And then the appropriators, House, Senate, come together, try to resolve their differences. Well, part of the stage we're at is the Republicans haven't resolved their own internal differences about these bills, right? And so you have appropriations bills that have come out of the House and out of the Senate, and the Republicans can't even get agreement with among the Republicans. And they're not sitting down. The appropriators have been sitting down with each other. They were working through a plan. Trump's administration told the Republicans to stop. And Trump, his first meeting on the budget was the day before the shutdown, where he seemed to not realize who Jeffries was, the House lead, Democratic leader.
Oh, he knew. He released an AI fake right before the meeting.
And he seemed confused about him. He seemed confused about a lot of things. You know, I mean, it was shocking. He golfed the entire weekend. Any other president would have spent the weekend trying to work out something. He spent it golfing. And maybe what else? He went to the, what was that, Ryder Cup?
The Ryder thing? Cup. Yeah, the golf.
Where they were all being rude to the Irish folks.
All right. We are talking about shutdown. We're talking about concerns over the firing of individuals during that shutdown. Jim Handler.
So I just wanted two quickies. One is Teresa said First Amendment, and that is actually, I want to say it's even more strong than that. It's the first article of the Constitution.
Yeah, so Article 1, totally base. My mistake. Sorry,
yeah,
sir.
Not a big deal. But well,
fired
the other
up
thing
and
is,
fired.
The other thing that has come up during this, and it was actually hidden deep within this article, but I think it's a really interesting one. When you lay someone off, you have to give them severance pay. That severance pay comes out of government money that is frozen during the shutdown.
So you can't do that.
So, well, there's this question of how the government could do a costly action without any congressional approval during the shutdown. So they keep saying, you know, we'll do this. It'll, you know, the Democrats have given us an excuse to fire all these people we wanted to fire anyway, except that they can't do it. So it's yet another misstatement from the Trump administration.
Sophia.
I think right now when it comes to the shutdown, I hate to say it, less concerned about what's happening in government and just more concerned about us. Like, I'm worried about the people that are getting laid off. I'm worried about, really, as an educator, about Head Start programs. Yeah. Head Start is a federal program across the U.S. that really helps children and low-income families. It offers educational services, health services, nutrition services, resources for parents. And there's a few programs that have grant cycles beginning in October 1st that were disrupted in their funding. And if the shutdown continues into November or December, more programs could be disrupted. So I'm always more concerned personally about what's happening to young people and what's happening to families.
And especially the long-range effects of if this grinds on for...
Absolutely.
A month or longer.
And these are all children, these are all children who are younger than five. And of course, I don't think the shutdown will be as extensive in affecting education as the pandemic was. But just to say that we are still seeing effects of what happened from elementary students who were in school during the pandemic and when they had learning loss. And now these are children who are missing out opportunities possibly in early childhood development and resources at a young age. So, you know, depending on how long this lasts, there could be lasting impacts.
And if America wants a future, those are our future.
That's right.
The I'd like to add to that, because there are a couple of other areas. There are many areas that are going to be important. What happens to TSA, you know, airport folks who are working hard and not getting paid, or air traffic controllers. You know, the last time, after a while, they just started calling in sick because, you know, remember, this time it's much more serious because the Trump administration has laid off enormous numbers of air traffic controllers, driven them out, so there aren't enough already. Mm-hmm. They're under tremendous stress. And now you add on top of that, they're not getting paid. And so if they start calling out, that's going to be a problem. A friend of mine alerted me to a Military Times story that talked about how yesterday in Texas there were long, long lines at the local food bank at the Y that serves this military base. And they showed pictures of nearly bare shelves. And they said just there's tremendous anxiety. And so they get paid, as I was talking to somebody yesterday, up till October 15th. But after October 15th, these military folks don't have a paycheck. The WIC program, the number of states can carry the WIC program. I was listening to one state official on a newscast yesterday saying that they can cover it for up to 48 days because they did some pre-planning and in anticipation. But beyond that, and for others, you know, it's a much shorter time horizon than that. So already there are people who want to buy homes, but you need federal, it requires federal flood insurance. You can always only get it through the federal government. They can't do that right now. And then there's another thing that might, when you're talking about, you know, women, infant children, pregnant women not getting the food and nutrition, SNAP, all of those things. There's actually a whole other issue about the number of military who are depending on SNAP benefits, who, if these Republican cuts get implemented as they're scheduled to and don't get changed, a number of military folks are going to be hurt by those SNAP benefits. But today, channeling Aaron Pacetti, the jobs report should have come out. And it's not coming out because those folks aren't working. But I will also add that the Trump administration says that there's no longer collecting some of the data that's supposed to be in the jobs report. So that's a whole other kettle of fish. And in any case, and one of the other things that they're doing that I think is potentially illegal, I've read different views on this, but maybe a violation of the Hatch Act, is what they're doing on the government websites. And so if you go to the HUD website, they have a big red banner that says, and I'm quoting, "The radical left in Congress shut down the government. HUD will use available resources to help Americans in need." Now, I thought that, and so that's unprecedented and may be a violation of the Hatch Act. But let's go back. How much do they really want to help people in need? I went back and looked at what the Trump vote Vance budget proposal was for HUD, Congressional Research Service. They requested $33.2 billion. That's a 59% cut in HUD's overall budget. That's what the Trump administration asked for HUD. And that means that they're eliminating Section 8 housing. They're eliminating community development block grant funds, housing for the elderly funding, housing for persons with disabilities, these self-sufficiency programs to assist people in housing stability, neighborhood housing grants. They are cutting funding, zero funding, the Office of Lead Hazard Control. It goes on and on and on. They want to defund the Section 8 program. So these folks put a banner that's probably illegal on the HUD website, that's Housing and Urban Development, yet, you know, don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget, and I'll tell you what you value. And they want to create a housing crisis. And it will create more homeless, yet they want to eliminate much of the funding for homeless programs.
Jim, just have about a minute before.
No, I was just nodding.
Oh, okay.
Well, what other programming? What about the university-based cuts?
On and on and on. The university challenges were otherwise. Many of the funding agencies already got their appropriation, but now they don't have the people necessarily to do the run the reviews, to do things. So it'll put another pause in an already broken system. But we're already fighting, I think. Somebody quoted me the number of lawsuits that concern the various kinds of cuts to educational support, not even including the H-1B visas, which is probably the most devastating for universities because a lot of our assistant professors are here on H-1Bs before they can get the kind of permanent visas that let them stay. And many of these are the top students from around the world who now we're saying, go away, we'll replace you with Americans, except we don't have the Americans in grad school and they can't afford to go to grad school because the government is cutting all the grants that paid for them to go to grad school.
Cancer research for kids.
So many impacts and dominoes that fall as a result of these decisions. David said whether or not they had the shutdown, cutting more federal employees is what Trump was going to attempt to do anyway. Any fantasies on the part of the Republicans that the Democrats will get blamed for the shutdown is in denial of the fact that they have been the moving party all year long and all the government destruction and downsizing and wrecking of the economy and all that. The vast majority of Americans, especially independents, not necessarily the people who've been drinking the toxic Kool-Aid all these years on the right, will clearly see that the destruction, what the destruction is, who's been doing it, and the Republicans will correctly get all the blame. That actually was exactly what we were talking about.
Yeah, so you know, the interesting thing, Joe, is I was listening to someone who I'm not always in complete agreement with, Newt Gingrich. In fact, I don't think. Never mind. I was going to say I'm not sure I've ever been in agreement, but
I lived through
this. But this is one thing I actually agree with him on. He said, "Whichever side has gotten the blame for the shutdown has always had to cave." But he was saying, and of course, he was blaming the Democrats for this one because he's Newt Gingrich. But interestingly, it's very unclear what happens when you have a split public that's sort of half the people are blaming one side and half for the other without knowing anything about it. And I think that's going to be really a determiner of how long this shutdown lasts.
That was Jim Hendler on the Roundtable panel on Friday, October 3rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.